In the most ancient scriptural texts, the Hebrew words designating the poor are concrete terms, beggar, puny one, cripple. They express the physical attitude of the poor. Over the centuries, these words gradually took on religious meaning. They came to express an attitude of soul, rather than a physical or sociological reality. The person who humbly seeks God, turns to Him, and fears and serves Him, has been called the poor man. It is easy to see how, over the years, there has been a shift from one meaning to the other. Quite naturally, the Jew who had no money or work, who did not eat his fill, whom the powerful persecuted, turned to God since he could obtain no help from men. Finally, during the last centuries before Jesus Christ, the poor, the Anoim, were the devout Jews whether or not they were deprived of material possessions. Besides, the name poor suited them. They, too, were in need, and were hungry and thirsty. They hungered and thirsted for the consolation of Israel, for God. It is to them that Christ spoke on the mountain, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, the afflicted, those who hunger." Cf. Mount 5:3-12. The most blessed one of all was Mary, because she was perfectly poor. Now do you understand why you need mental prayer? For a half hour a day, it makes you a poor man. Choose to be blessed. Do you see why I say that your ineptness at mental prayer is a benefit? It helps you to discover and accept, not only your inability to pray, but even more fundamentally, your inability to save yourself by your own means. It forces you to adopt the attitude of a beggar, who trusts that everything will be given to him freely by God's inexhaustible love. Please persevere. Gradually, peace will replace your exasperation, and you will find that you can remain at the Lord's feet, happy to be poor. You will at last have discovered that to pray is to lay one's poverty before the eyes of God. When you feel the need, make use of the prayers of the poor, often called little ones, the lowly, the oppressed, the miserable ones, that have been preserved for us in the Psalter. 27. Declaring bankruptcy. Do you know what I was thinking, as I read your last letter? That you are acting like a business executive even in your life of mental prayer? Believe me, I do not scorn the businessman that you are. Rather, I have a secret admiration for the human gifts which make up your strength and your success: initiative, clarity of vision, the will to succeed, a sense of organization and command, and efficiency. But mental prayer is not a human affair, and the mentality of the businessman has no place in it. Now, I believe I glimpse signs of this mentality in your reactions. During our first encounter, you asked me to suggest subjects for mental prayer, and you were disappointed when I told you that I knew of none better than the Gospels. You answered, "Reading the Gospel doesn't help me very much to pray." In your letter, you complain that you cannot find a precise method of mental prayer in our Kahirs. This seems to reveal your business executive mentality, concerned with efficiency, productivity, and profits. Far be it from me to think or say anything against the ancient instinct to succeed that is embedded deep within our being. Mankind owes its development and progress to it. The evils associated with the desire to succeed are caused, not by it, but by its perversion, by egotism, ambition, and the will to power. But this instinct to succeed is the worst possible obstacle to prayer. Mental prayer is not a human undertaking, to be successfully executed. It is a willingness to give in. That is perhaps why you find it so difficult. In your eyes, to abdicate is the worst cowardice. After all, isn't a difficulty meant to be mastered and opposition meant to be overcome? You are probably right where business is concerned, but not in the realm of prayer. You are engaged in mental prayer. You question a page of the Gospel, and it does not answer. You knock, and the door remains closed. That is enough to exasperate you. It is not one of your habits to accept resistance on the part of men and things. And besides, You reflect, what good is it to dawdle, to lose precious time that could be used more effectively, perhaps even in God's service? Or else you say, let someone else find an efficient method. Well, no, you must accept the resistance of that page which withholds its secrets from you. It is not a question of seeking another, more eloquent page, or taking up a more stimulating book of spirituality, or of discovering an infallible method of meditation. You need to confess that you are powerless to understand God's thoughts, to humiliate yourself in the presence of this mute text, to prostrate yourself before God's silent transcendence. You need to wait in the attitude of the repentant sinner until the Lord deigns to have pity, and grants you the grace of prayer. You have no right at all to this grace. God will give it to you freely in His own time. Grace is freely given, and is not capricious. If it is slow in coming, it is not that God hesitates to give. It is because you are slow to clear the paths by which the Lord wants to take possession of your being. A memory comes to mind whose meaning you should grasp better than anyone. A friend of mine was about to declare the bankruptcy of his business. His wife came to see me one day, greatly disturbed. She could not understand her husband's reaction to this situation, which she described to me. I cannot find words to translate what is going on inside of him, suffering, collapse, words such as these do not apply. It is much more than suffering, and it is not collapse, since he is reacting and doing everything that the situation demands. It is a kind of death, as if he had been stricken in the wellsprings of his life, in his dignity as a man. It seems that we women are incapable of imagining the interior disaster that failure means to a man when it affects his undertakings, his creative activity. We experience such distress only at the level of love. I am sure that you evaluate better than my visitor this dismay of a man confronting bankruptcy. Might not your revulsion against mental prayer be of the same nature? In the mainstream of your life you are a success, but here you are a failure. Everywhere else you are called upon to combat, but here you are required to abdicate, to declare bankruptcy. That goes counter to all your habits, and more than that, counter to the essential aspirations of your being. You love to conquer, and you are right in feeling that way. But please understand that where God is concerned, our victory is to consent to be conquered. Consider Saint Paul on the road to Damascus. In your daily activities, you say, I want. At mental prayer, you must say, I beg of you. There you are no longer the man who wields authority, but the child who asks, the beggar who holds out his hand, the failure who accepts humiliation. To succeed in life we need to know, to will, and to have the power to do. To succeed in mental prayer you need to agree to know nothing, will nothing, and have power to do nothing, so that God may give you His knowledge, His will, and His power. Some time ago you said to me, that's contrary to nature. Yes, I can readily see that it is torture for you more than for someone else, to remain there powerless before God. I can understand that you would prefer any activity at all, indeed, any other kind of torture but this. But it is precisely through mental prayer that this turning around of your nature will come about, this conversion that is the only way of adapting yourself to God's action. On the other hand, don't imagine that I am inviting you to a quietistic passivity. To abdicate, to declare bankruptcy at the hour of mental prayer, is a very positive act. It implies intense spiritual activity. It presupposes that you believe in God present and acting, that you are mercilessly mortifying everything in you that clamors to live and to succeed. It presupposes that you are giving yourself, or rather are waiting patiently, in an attitude of offering and receptiveness, for God to come and take possession of you. 28. Dependence. First of all, here is the principal passage of a letter I have just received. I am 40 years old and I've never been sick until now. This is an entirely new experience for me, And I assure you, not a pleasant one. During the first days, revolt rumbled within me that I was, passing from hand to hand like a lost and found object being wantonly handled, and without anyone's even deigning to give a serious answer to my demands for explanations. And to think that in my daily life I cannot tolerate to have my secretary move even my paper cutter on my desk. What a horrible feeling of being nothing more than a thing. Certainly, a thing that is being taken care of, examined, repaired, and whose proper functioning is being checked out, but nevertheless a thing, that is to say, a passive, inanimate being. I thought with envy of the most miserable hobo. Anyone who disposes of himself freely is a great lord by comparison with this middle-class businessman in a comfortable hospital who has become a thing controlled by others. I want to tell you what went through my mind when I read these lines. This will be a continuation of our last conversation. My correspondent is right. There is nothing more intolerable for a free man, legitimately proud of his self-determination, than to become dependent on others. That means losing his dignity as a human person. But the truth is that independence is of the spiritual order. In a hospital, in a concentration camp, amid tortures, men and women can remain free. Their bodies are the prey of others, but their souls can escape capture. It is only when man abdicates that he becomes a thing. I acknowledge, nonetheless, that physical dependence is a restriction to man's independence. That is the first reason why it appears intolerable to him. Well now, this independence is what a lover feels, an irrepressible need to sacrifice to the one he loves, precisely because it is his most precious possession. To sacrifice this possession is the irrefutable proof that he loves the other more than himself. To pray is to transpose these sentiments into our relations with God. It is to be happy and proud to be God's property. It is to repose in a dependence that is accepted, willed, and loved. The man of prayer cherishes this dependence the more that he discovers it to be radical and innate. He has the power to revolt against it, but he cannot change the fact that he is indebted to God for his very existence, not just once and for all, but at every moment of his life. Mental prayer is the time when, driving off the illusion of autonomy, man becomes aware again of his fundamental dependence. It is the time when he consents to this dependence, and places himself once more into the Father's hands to be disposed of as God wills. In manus tuas, Domine. Into your hands, Lord, I commend my spirit. There was an old priest who understood this very well. His entire spiritual life gravitated around the idea of his dependence vis-a-vis God. One day he confided to me, "I need only think of the word dependence to be deep in mental prayer." 29. The Watermark. After writing you that one of the fundamental attitudes of mental prayer is to offer oneself to the Lord, I have had second thoughts. Am I perhaps leading you into an error so common that it is surprising that anyone has escaped it? Each of us likes to believe he is his own master, autonomous and free. And we think the most beautiful act is precisely to renounce our independence, to proclaim our dependence upon God by giving ourselves to Him. Some of us are even close to thinking that the Lord really owes us something in exchange for this gift, a certain esteem and gratitude. It is true that there is nothing nobler than for a free person to agree to depend on another through love. Such, for example, is the case of a bride on her wedding day. But it is not true that we are our own masters in our relations with God. Hold a piece of bond paper up to the light, and you will read the name of the manufacturer in the watermark. Look at a man in the light of God, and you will discover the name of his Lord inscribed in the very fabric of his being. Man is made by God and belongs to him the same way a crop belongs to a farmer, or a sculpture to an artist. And not merely the same way, but much more so. Things belong to a man because they are the fruit of his labors, but they do not owe their total being to him. He did not create them. Man receives everything from God.